Hey everyone, this is Eddie Fettig, aka Destiny Smasher. Welcome to the Same Skycast, where we're bringing all worlds together under the same sky. This is the fourth bonus stage episode for April 2010. I'm going to be interviewing Brent Black. You probably know him better as Brental Floss.
Once again, we're hurled into darkness and great upheaval. Those who can enlist, let's unite, and we'll fight together. We must save the crystals or orbs or the moon, whatever. Come, let's fly. We'll sail where the wind may take us through that starry sky. 'Cause apparently back then they had ships that could do that. Draw your sword and stick it in trees that have human features.
Hey there guys, it's Eddie Fettig, aka Destiny Smasher, the reviews editor at GoNintendo.com. Welcome to the Same Skycast. Today I have another special guest over from ScrewAttack.com. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
How's it going, everybody? This is Brental Floss. And if you don't know what I do, my main shtick is I add video... Stutterfest 2010. I take video game music and I add lyrics, like satirical lyrics, kind of a Weird Al style kind of thing. And in general, I'm a composer and a lyricist in the video game milieu.
Right. And I just recently reviewed your first album. I'll have a link to that in the description of the episode here. But I just wanted to have Brent on so we could discuss his work and his album, that sort of thing. So my first question is, how long have you been doing the whole what if dot 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 had lyrics thing? How long have you been doing that?
Well, that concept just kind of popped into my head in July of 08, so just coming up on 2 years. It's still a pretty young, as a concept, it's still pretty young.
Okay. How many songs you've done that to in total?
Of the ones that have made it to video, I think it's somewhere around 20, if you don't count the ones that are brand new from the album, somewhere around 20, possibly 25, but that also includes, I did, for instance, the MacGyver theme with lyrics.
Yeah.
And a couple things that are video game related but are not, in fact, video game music that have lyrics. So, there's a Venn diagram of different concepts that all sort of are part of the same channel. But, yeah.
Yeah. How long have you been doing music?
Since I was in the womb, really. My Sonogram was a hell of a show. I started playing piano kind of spontaneously at age 8. I started writing music kind of spontaneously at age, I guess, 11 or 12. A year or two after that, started writing lyrics. Everything was kind of, no one said, hey, you really ought to write a lyric, your old Brent. It just kind of, I don't know, I think some of us are, whether it's genetic or whatever it is, we are just programmed, hardwired from birth to, come up with certain things and to tend towards certain things. And, mine wasn't really football or science or whatever. I just, was a kind of music and lyrics kind of kid. So, yeah. Wrote my first musical. That's kind of my alter ego, is I actually do write musical theater. And I wrote my first musical late high school. That was actually produced my senior year of high school. And,
cool.
Yeah, kept doing that through college. So it's funny, that's actually, not that you asked this, but as long as I'm rambling, that's actually kind of what the With Lyrics series grew out of, because there's a weird little program at NYU. It's a 2-year program called the Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program.
Okay.
And you get a master's in musicals. You kind of choose whether your emphasis is lyrics or music. So I, essentially, 2 months prior to my first With Lyrics video, I had gotten a master's in writing lyrics, as weird as that sounds. So, it's kind of fitting that the series would, highlight lyrics as a concept.
Right. Huh, that's interesting. So, I mean, you started off, you didn't really get any formal kind of training until until, like, in college, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I never got any performance training, but I did take one semester of composition in college, and then later in grad school, you know, obviously that was formal training in writing. So up until that point, that would be correct.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I just sort of, I mean, a part of it is just the nature of your work, but just when I listen to your work, it doesn't come across to me as something that's, like, specifically, like, from a formal background, and that's, I mean, that's not a bad thing in my opinion, because I guess in my opinion, when it comes to music, sometimes if people focus too much on the technicality and the formality, that they kind of you can sometimes lose the kind of soul behind it.
Exactly.
And like I was commenting on your review, on the review of your album, like, with a lot of times with your music, like, I just feel like you get into it, like, you just do it because you seem to be enjoying what you're doing. And there's another musician, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, named Jonathan Mann. He kind of used to do like, adding lyrics he did like the first half of a Mario musical called the Mario Opera. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I have seen videos of it. It was pretty out there, from what I remember.
Yeah, it was. It's definitely strange. I actually kind of wish he would finish it at some point. But, like, he kind of does that too. And, I mean, not to, like, insult him or anything, but I feel like your, like, vocal qualities are more, I don't know how to say it, but, like, they come across as more formal than Jonathan Mann's. But at the same time, like Jonathan Mann can, like, when he sings, like, he puts his heart into it. Like, even if he's not quite singing on key all the time or whatever, like, you can tell he loves what he's doing. And, like,
sure,
that always has more of an effect on me and how much I enjoy a piece than just the technical aspects. But
right. Well, and that's, you know, that's kind of what I count on when I go into a live show, because as many musicians know, it's one thing to be comfortable in an air-conditioned recording studio, just kind of sitting or standing at, you know, at rest essentially, and sing, you know, three or four takes and take the best parts. It's a very different thing to have the adrenaline rush of being in front of hundreds of people and being kind of the only guy on a large stage. You know what I mean? Like, what I'm saying is I rely on the notion that they'll appreciate, even if I'm not hitting every note perfectly, and even if, you know, like, the mix is off or whatever, or even if I forget words, which does happen occasionally in live performances, they'll appreciate that I'm, you know, putting my all into it, and the energy is there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Speaking of, like, sort of the technical stuff, how much time and effort sort of went into making this album from a technical standpoint, like, have, you know, that higher level of quality so that it, you know, sounded more professional and all that? Like, how many people were involved, and, like, how much time did you end up spending altogether?
Actually, there were really, in terms of creating something that wasn't there before, there were really only three people. Joe Skinner is my sound engineer, and throughout college, when I went to the University of Oklahoma, he actually was, he helped produce two CDs that I made during that time of the two musicals that I wrote in college. And so we had a good rapport and a good knowledge of how we worked in the, you know, in the studio already. Well, it just so happened he moved about an hour away from where I am in New York, and it became very feasible for me to take a train up there. And, you know, so I thought, you know, why don't we just try this out? And before we knew it, we had 20 tracks planned. And, you know, we started principal recording in, I believe, late September, early October. And we didn't work every week. We probably worked once or twice a month. I'd go up there for one or two days at a time. And so, you know, it was a very long-term project in that way.
Yeah.
For an album. Because, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't really know how long they usually take, but I imagine that more often it's a situation where the vocals are all done within a matter of a few days, and then possibly, you know, all the producing is done kind of in a row, whereas we did it a bit more stretched out.
Yeah.
But the third person was Daniel Tidwell, is Daniel Tidwell, a very, very talented, phenomenal guitarist who, I would say, basically, he's the guitar version of me. He takes themes everybody knows and makes them more awesome through the use of a scorching electric guitar. His YouTube channel is MetalDaniel03, he's just a phenomenal guitarist. And I actually met him at MAGFest, which is a music and gaming convention in Virginia. I met him there around New Year's, and we just hit it off. And he knew my stuff from YouTube, so I listened to his CD. And actually, I put it on. This is kind of neither here nor there, but I put the CD on while I was in the shower at MAGFest, and by the time that shower was done, I was like, I have to ask this guy to be on my CD. He has a sense of improving things that is hard to match. You know what I mean? Not just doing justice to it, but heightening what is already there. So we three in conjunction basically made it. But I should also shout out to the Konami Code and the Megas,
yeah,
who are two bands who basically were kind enough to let me, you know, I call them collaboration sometimes, but really what it was they allowed me to take two tracks of theirs and add vocals in a way that, you know, like altered it forever, you know, made it more of a track that it simulates, I guess, a live performance in the studio, but ultimately me adding either lyrics in the first place or more lyrics to one
right.
of the songs.
Right. Yeah, I liked how those tracks came out, and the stuff that Daniel Tidwell did, like that, that was probably one of the main aspects of the album that I really felt kind of helped add an extra layer of polish to it. Like
right.
with the Final Fantasy Classic song and the Mega Man 3 with lyrics song. I mean, those are two of my favorite tracks in the album. And like, I deliberately remember when I heard those songs, like, ooh, nice guitar going on here. Where do you get this guy from? So
yeah, if there's any regret, well, I don't want to use the word regret, but if there's any like thing that when I listen to it, because you know, like once you rap and once you can't change it, you start listening to it and going, oh man, it's a scary thing to send it off to print and knowing that anything that you don't like is that way forever.
Yeah.
But the only thing I think that I might change if I ever like wanted to do some kind of director's cut is that there are a few songs with MIDI guitar, and you know, it's high end MIDI, so the average listener does not get preoccupied with
yeah.
fakeness. But knowing what Daniel can do, there are a few songs where I go, man, I wonder what this would have sounded like with Daniel on it. But I mean, you know, that's the fact that that's, you know, my only actual thing that I, you know, regret about the CD is I think pretty good.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a good kind of thing. That's just a testament to how much you like what Dan creates there.
Absolutely. And I do plan to you know, if he'll be in my posse, I plan to keep him around as long as possible, because he's just phenomenal.
Cool. So with the Konami Code and the Megas, where did that come about? Like, did you approach those guys and be like, hey, I'm making an album, you want me to do some crazy stuff to one of your songs?
Interestingly enough, they're both two, I guess the stories aren't terribly unique, but they're different. I actually met the Konami Code and the Megas both at my first, well, really the second game convention I ever did, but the first one that I ever did with other bands. And the Code was cool, and, you know, like, we traded CDs, and the next day, this was a game, Unicon, last July, and the day after they gave me their CD, I'd listened to their cut of Paperboy. There's actually a video on YouTube of when this happened. I listened to it, and I like, dashed off a first draft of a lyric in about half an hour and ran down to show it to them, just because I loved that song, I loved that game, and I loved their version of it.
Cool.
And we just always said, you know, in the future at some point, this should really be a video, me doing Paperboy to you guys' version of Paperboy. But later I realized that track is not really conducive as much. I mean, it might be a video one day, but it was more like, this should be a track on a CD.
Right, yeah.
Their rock fusion breakdown is just such a cool thing to have on the CD. It's kind of like one of those something for everyone kind of moments where it's like, not everyone likes a 4-minute jazz fusion breakdown. But for people who do, it's a pretty amazing, you know, little break to listen to. And so that was the Konami Code. In the case of the Megas, I also met them again, Unicon, and I also played with them again, or not, I played alongside them, essentially, at MAGFest. And it had just occurred to me in the fall that they had done a version of the Mega Man 2 Dr. Wily's Level 1 and 2 theme that was essentially the opposite of mine. You know, structurally, just to get a little bit nerdy on you with the music, structurally there's like three or four sections to that song, and I had added lyrics to like two or three of them. And it seemed that all the ones that I added lyrics to, they didn't. They just played instrumentally in a stroke of amazing luck. So it's like when I would sing my version of it while listening to their version, it seemed to fit pretty well.
Cool.
So it just was a no-brainer. I said, can I, you know, get that track from you guys? They said yes, and they just fit together so well. It was just, you know, kind of meant to be.
Okay, and that explains why the name of that track is, it's one name slash another name. I was actually wondering why that was, but that makes sense. That's interesting. That's pretty cool. That was another one of my favorite tracks on the CD. That one in particular, despite the fact that it's making obvious references to like robots and Dr. Wily and his mustache and like stuff like that, that was one of the tracks that felt more like mainstream, like more the type of song that even if you weren't familiar with the game or the song that it was based on, that you could still get into it. My wife actually was, you know, as we were listening, as I was showing her that track for the first time, she's like, wait, is this still from that video game CD you're listening to? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh, well, that's pretty cool. And I had to remind her what the song was because she actually is somewhat familiar with that song. But, you know, just the fact that it's, that it has that kind of tone to it where it's, you know, it obviously you injected some parody into it, but at the same time, it's still like more serious because of the way that the Megas approached it.
Right.
So it was an interesting fusion. I definitely like that.
Our flavors are very different. And I have to say, I really do respect what the Megas do with the video game lore. I did a review of their latest album, Get Acoustic, which is basically the acoustic version of that same album, Get Equipped. I think I should say they sort of showed me what you can do with video game, just to use a nerdy word, with like the mythos of these video games.
Yeah.
And I would credit them for kind of opening the door for me to do something like the 2-2 Blues, which you and I have kind of personally talked about.
Yeah, I love that song.
It's just so different from what I usually do. And I think that, you know, it's like, it's sort of like taking it out of a world where there needs to be a laugh and taking it into a world where these stories we all know suddenly have depth and humanity in them. And it's like, yeah, you know, that sounds really gay. It sounds really nerdy and artsy. But it's like, if there's a huge chunk of the population that has not only, you know, experienced these stories, but they literally lived them because they played them interactively, then it sort of has a funny way of kind of making the listener a little bit more vulnerable because you go, yeah, that was me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when I was, it's not when I watched Mega Man or when I heard about Mega Man or read Mega Man. When I was Mega Man, I was Mario, and that's why I feel like, video games are potentially one of the best storytelling mediums that we have right now.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully we won't get too off track here, but just especially over the course of the past few years, I think that a lot of artists that create video games have really been exploring that idea and in some cases even playing around with it and twisting it and making us like think about that sort of aspect that they're interactive, that we're playing roles in these stories and stuff. So.
Absolutely.
You and the Megas, and I'm sure there's others out there that maybe I'm not familiar with, just sort of exploring that idea through music and using those, you know, these songs that their melodies, you know, evoke these memories of us going through these things and going through these kind of interactive experiences and adding some more, like, depth and humanity to them, as you put it. I just think that that's something really cool and worth looking into. I remember when you first put that up, your description of the video, you seemed like you were kind of like hesitant about it. Were you like worried that a lot of your fans who expect like comedy maybe like wouldn't appreciate that song very much or something?
Well, you know, it's always with someone like me, I'm always someone who in life and in my art, I cover up pain with humor. That's what most comedians do.
Yeah.
You know, comedy generally is pain. It's just, you know, if I fall and slip on a banana peel, to me, that's tragedy. If you fall and slip on a banana peel, to me, that's comedy. To you, it's tragedy. But, you know, like, the point is that my usual take on things is one of making light of vulnerability so that we don't have to feel the pain part. So when I decide to go and do something that shows any kind of vulnerability, any kind of real deep human condition shit, it's, by the way, are we PG or what's the deal with that?
No, you don't have to worry about that. If we end up being explicit, I can just mark that on the,
okay.
So don't worry about it. Just
I'll try to watch it. But the point is the few times that I have opened up a little bit and shown a side of my art that isn't just jokes, that in fact kind of shows, a side of humanity, but inevitably a side of myself, it's always a scary thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the best people that write, let's just take out of the, like, I don't know, someone like Tori Amos, who I'm not a huge, huge fan of, but, you know, she writes a lot of brooding, serious songs, and you can just tell she's putting a piece of herself on the page. She's playing, you know, she's playing a part of herself for everybody. And so, I had the same feeling in a smaller way when I first came out with Final Fantasy Classic with lyrics, if you believe it or not. I felt like it was the least funny of any of the lyrics videos to date, and it was the most celebratory and the most kind of nostalgic.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to potentially make it a flop, and that ended up making it one of the more popular, especially in a culty way, just because people get into the nostalgia and into the emotions they felt following
right.
the story.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm learning, I guess as everyone, who makes art learns at some point that there's just as much potential when you open up a vulnerable part of yourself as when you share kind of a satirical and cynical part of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, speaking as a writer, I know exactly what type of thing you're talking about. Although lately, a lot of my writing is obviously more editorial, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
I used to write a lot of fiction, and I actually still do from time to time. I'm still slowly working my way through a piece of fiction. And I mean, I'm not going to lie, and this is kind of embarrassing, but most of the fiction I write is fan fiction. I just try to do. I try to do something different with it than I feel like most of the fanfiction I've ever read does, and it's exactly... And sorry for the hiccup in the podcast here, guys. I was, I don't know what happened. The audio kind of messed up on me. So basically, I was just talking about how it's exactly what he's going at, where the whole, like, incorporating yourself into the work and just putting this actual emotion into it and that sort of thing. So let's just keep going with that. Especially over the past couple of years as I've been graduating college and getting married and starting to live on my own and stuff, like injecting myself into it and exploring my own like vulnerability through my writing. And
right.
I mean, obviously that can be kind of difficult sometimes, but I feel like ultimately that sort of thing ends up being more rewarding for both the creator and the person that is observing the art that you've made.
Right.
Because I'm just of the opinion that when it comes to any kind of art, the more reality that gets injected and mixed in with the fantasy, the more that ends up ultimately like touching the other person that's experiencing it. Because I feel like the more reality is injected into the fantasy, the more that the other person can somewhat connect to in a way.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Well, it's just a matter of you can tell a good piece of art by whether people can see themselves in it or whether they can relate to it in some way. And yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. But it is a scarier proposition to a lot of people to show a side of themselves that is, taking a bigger risk. It's not as big of a risk to kind of make a snide comment about something as it is to say, I'm a person, and when this happens, it hurts. You know what I mean? Like, it's
definitely.
Much of a thing. But, there, like you said, there is a bigger reward. And I think when you look at the lasting works of art throughout history, we don't know a lot of knock-knock jokes from biblical times. But we do know the beautiful stuff. We know the poetry and the Psalms. And, we don't remember a whole lot of, limericks from Shakespeare's day, but we remember the tragedies. And we don't get a lot of the jokes in the comedies. His comedies don't age as well, but his tragedies do because they're still true, that there's something true about them that everyone can connect to regardless of culture and time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
and what I mean by that is that people are going to still be singing the Tutu Blues in 3,000 years. That's basically what I'm getting at. I'm just kidding.
no, like
me trying to be dry on the internet doesn't always work.
No, I mean, in a way, like, I definitely agree with that. Like, I definitely feel like that song is going to be one of your longer lasting ones because of the very fact that it's like that song is there to reach out to the other person's, like, to their heart, to their soul, not just to, like, make them laugh. And that's not to say that there's anything that is less interesting or less worthwhile about making people laugh, but you're right. There's, like, more of a timeless quality to it.
Absolutely.
And that's definitely interesting. Like, are you planning on, like, you know, trying to mix in more songs like that into your work? Like, Okay.
I am. The thing is, I'm always obsessed with giving something a name. A great example of that is Beerix. You know, Beerix wouldn't have happened if I didn't come up with the name Beerix, because I thought about taking the YouTube poop route and calling it With Unfitting Lyrics, but I thought, you know, that's just not catchy. Like, who wants to hear unfitting lyrics?
Right.
But Beerix, now that's funny. And the thing is, you know, it's not like it's some genius, multi-million-dollar idea, but, like, the literally shorts. You know, like, if I didn't have that name for it, I wouldn't do it. And in the same way, I really like the idea of starting a series that is similar but distinct from the With Lyrics series. But I don't know yet what it would be called. If you look at certain things that I've done, you know, the truth about Toad, you could argue, isn't really a With Lyrics.
True.
Because it's not about the game that the tune is from. So if you think of it, and I'm also writing a tune, this is sort of a teaser for anyone who follows the Parental Plot. This is sort of like a preview. But I'm writing a song that combines the tune from when you beat the original Legend of Zelda, which really what Koji Kondo did was he took the Game Over theme and created a counter melody with it. It's a completely obscure, rarely played little tune, but it very much has a 1930s crooner kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a song kind of done in like a distorted microphone, like, waiting on the levee, here I am, you know, like that kind of thing. But it's going to be about the fact that Link, you know, I was thinking about it, the fact that you beat that game and there's a second quest. Why is there a second quest? And I just thought about it and I thought, well, what if Link really only likes Zelda, really only wants to be with her when he can't have her? You know, everyone has that to some extent. Everyone has, like, you only want what you can't have kind of thing, forbidden fruit. So what if Link actually really just wanted Zelda to get kidnapped one more time, just so he could go through all the fun, you know, part of rescuing her and kind of metaphorically having her be like the Christmas gift inside the box, you know, it's always more fun before you opened it up. So I'm writing this song that's got this crooner, you know, By the Light of the Silvery Moon kind of Al Jolson feel to that tune that's not really Link singing it, even though it's from his perspective, in the same way that the Tutu Blues wasn't really Mario per se.
Yeah, but
it was the spirit of Mario in some weird way.
Yeah.
So the very short version of this long ramble is I do plan to keep doing things that aren't with lyrics. I don't know what to call them yet, but not only do I have plans, but I actually have drafts I'm working on that are going to be in that vein. So definitely going to be a bigger part of what I do in the future.
Awesome. Totally looking forward to that stuff. I mean, I definitely like your comedy works, but that one song is the first one of your works that really, like, specifically reached out to me in a very different way, and I'd love to see more of that too. So that's good to hear. I'm glad that you're pursuing that stuff. So I guess another question I have is, where does Brental Floss come from?
You know, it's I really wish I had a great story for this. I should think of something about, you know, I always want to say, oh, you know, I went to dental school or something. But no, the truth is, in 2004, I had an email address that was not working for me. My actual name is Brent Black, and I had an email address that was one word, Brent Brack. And you find out just how many dyslexic friends you have when you have an email address like that, because so many people would read it and somehow they would read my actual name, so they would email me. I wouldn't get it. That was my screen name for a long time. And after a while, I was like, I've got to change my screen name. It's got to be something kind of punny, you know, something that sort of describes me, has my name in it. And it was, you know, it was pretty arbitrary. It could have been Brenter of the Universe. It could have been, you know, sometimes people call me Brentel Patient instead of Mental Patient or stuff like that, Brentelman. But it just came out Brentelfloss. That became my screen name. And when I created a YouTube account, it became the obvious choice. And it really wasn't an identity until the FAQ, the very first FAQ. Because people would say, hello, Brentelfloss, in their messages. I never thought of myself as Brentelfloss. Maybe once or twice people had called me that because they'd seen my screen name or they'd seen my, you know, they'd call me that as a nickname. But after that, friends of mine started calling me Brentel, and it just stuck. I don't know why, but it just, I mean, probably because I said it 20 times in that FAQ video, but since then, you know, just that's what it's been. But the thing I like about it is it's broad enough that it doesn't require me to do specific things. You know, whereas like something like the Angry Video Game Nerd, who, by the way, is a sweetheart of a guy, and I have the utmost respect for him. You know, the tricky thing about being the Angry Video Game Nerd is he would have a harder time breaking out of being angry or being a nerd or it being about video games. He's very smart by being he's James Rolfe when he does the Cinemassacre stuff. But if he didn't have that, you know, it might be a hard thing to break out of. Whereas I feel like the advantage of something like Brentelfloss, which, again, I kind of stumbled into, is that it doesn't require me to do anything in particular. All it does is requires me to be whatever Brentelfloss is that day. So
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, mine just sort of came about because I like Smash Brothers a lot. So, and I just sort of I signed up for a Smash Brothers message forum back in the days when the second Smash Brothers game was getting ready to release, and I was all hyped up about it, whatever. And I just sort of you know, came up with the name Destiny Smasher, combining the name of a story, part of the name of a story I was writing, with just Smash Brothers, and that just sort of stuck. And then later on, I added the 3 and the 4 and the underscore in there to make it a little more internet-y.
Sure, a little bit more leak.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just always been my, that's my online moniker. If a game has enough space that allows me to fit that name in there, I'll use that too. But
nice.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that on the way over. I think, you know, you might want to just, I mean, if I were you, I would pretend that it was an occupation. Like, Eddie Fettig, Destiny Smasher.
People make jokes about that. Like, whenever I show up, like, to a new site, people be like, so, do you, like, smash people's destinies or something? Or, like...
Some people are heartbreakers, I'm a Destiny Smasher, you know, it's whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, so that's always been, it's always been kind of a funny name because people don't ever quite know what to make of it. And I kind of like that because, I don't know, I like for people not to ever quite know what to make of my reviews at first glance. Like, I know when some people do reviews, I mean, like, you know, going back to the Angry Video Game Nerd, you expect him to, like, ridicule the crap out of most of the games he reviews. But I want people to kind of not know what to expect from me until they actually read what I have to write. And, you know, some of my reviews I try to be really mean and nasty because I really didn't enjoy something. And others I try to be really generous because I really liked what I saw. And, you know, so it just kind of, it kind of works that way. But
gotcha.
So you said, you told me earlier that you only recently got a Wii. I'm assuming that's probably only the first console of this this current generation, if you will, of gaming that you really gotten. Do you, like, how often do you actually play video games?
Well, the thing is, without going into what I own, I do play video games fairly often, but, well, you know what? I mean, the thing is, you know, if members of your audience were to, many of them were to think, what does it mean to me to play video games often? They would probably think every day, every other day at least, which is what I did when I was, I don't know, ages 4 through 17 or 18. It was probably, you know, daily, if not every other day, certainly.
Yeah.
But nowadays, to me, when I think about playing a lot, you know, I, as I said, I write musicals, and I meet at least 3 times a week with my collaborator who we're working on a show right now. We don't go a day of collaboration without playing either Super Street Fighter 2 or Star Fox 64.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, I mean, and I feel like I am, while I'm sure someone can beat the two of us at Super Street Fighter 2, you know, you get pretty good after a while. But, you know, that's a far cry from, say, you know, playing Mass Effect 2, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do play games like that at my friends' houses, and, you know, most of my friends, particularly guy friends, do have current-gen consoles. And for that reason, it's not as pressing for me to keep up with all the new stuff myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the kind of thing where, frankly, I'm just realizing, and I don't know if this sounds, you know, greasy or what, but the truth is, I really like sharing in what's going on with things that everyone. Okay, sorry, collecting my thoughts briefly. I'm much better in writing. Thing is, I think I'm at my best when I can take a community that knows about a specific thing and sort of hold up a mirror to that community and say, this is my interpretation of what we all know and love.
Yeah.
An example of that was a musical that I wrote in college. My capstone was called OUsical, the musical, when I went to OU. And it was a parody of pretty much everything at that school. Well, it was a huge hit for everyone in that audience.
At that school,
Yeah, but if you had, like, put the same show on at UCLA, it probably would have been a flop. And in the same way, another example is the Corey song, which is on my CD, but, you know, while it's a cute song for anyone, I think that the people at the Screw Attack Gaming Convention last year, when that was a surprise song about Corey, who's on their website, they went nuts because that was me writing a song for something so specific that had to do with them.
Yeah.
So through the With Lyrics series, I kind of realized I'm part of a community that's gigantic, and yet, even though it's gigantic international worldwide, we still all have a few experiences that are common, you know?
Yeah.
And what I'm realizing with next-gen gaming is there's an even bigger pool of people that are playing games right this second.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't I, if I enjoy the MP3s that I hear of the Super Mario Galaxy game, well, why shouldn't I be playing that game and writing lyrics to that game? There's just no reason not to, A, tap into that market, but B, there's so much, you know, there's so much fun to be had in the current gen, and if I just dust my old rickety self off and realize that side scrollers are not the end all be all, and that 3D is okay, I too can enjoy everything that, you know, 10-year-olds the world over get to enjoy every day.
Yeah. So is that like something that you're wanting to look into more as you continue to make more of these songs?
Yeah. The truth is that at some point, songs from my childhood that I actually had an emotional connection with are finite. There's only so many of them that right. I actually... And the thing is, the majority of them have been covered. I've covered most of the games and most of the songs that I really, really liked growing up. And, of course, that's the ones that I did first because they were the ones that, you know, get stuck in your head. I've probably got maybe another 5 or 10... songs that are, you know, pre 2000 that I could do, and there will always be more.
Yeah, definitely.
But, like, at some point, if there's this, you know, every time I go to a gaming convention, I'm blown away by how inclusive this community of gamers is. And if I choose not to participate in what they're participating in a way, I'm kind of going against the grain in a way that doesn't help me in any way. So the short version is, there's all these games they're playing. I'm not playing them. And if I were, I would have a better understanding of where they're coming from and thereby be able to make better videos that they can get into.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, not just people my age or people that have played that game on their Game Boy, you know, and so forth.
Definitely. No, that's definitely something that that I think would be really awesome to see, like more, you know, your sort of comical take on more recent games that even more people are familiar with. I think that, in a in a big way, it makes a lot of sense that at least starting off, you focus more on the retro games, because, I mean, let's face it, a lot of the people that, you know, take time out of their day to go to ScrewAttack.com or to go on, even on YouTube and deliberately listen to, like, your videos and stuff, are going to tend to be more the type of people who grew up with that sort of game and have been playing games, you know, as they've grown up and stuff.
Right, right.
But now that you've got, now that you've gained more ground and then you've gotten more of a name for yourself and there's more people that are aware of your work, it would make sense to start making more songs that a wider group of people that are familiar with. And I wouldn't be surprised if in pursuing that you, you know, expand your audience even more. So that's, I mean, that's just more good stuff to hear that you're sort of expanding on and looking toward.
Yeah, and the thing is, ultimately, there are dumb things to be found everywhere.
Definitely.
I was a big fan growing up of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and, you know, they just happened upon a concept, which was, there's a lot of dumb shit in bad movies.
Yeah.
And we can make fun of it and get paid. Well, you know, in doing the With Lyrics series, the first With Lyrics, which was Mega Man 3, it didn't poke a whole lot of holes in Mega Man 3. It didn't, you know, point out how dumb it was.
Yeah.
But there were elements where, you know, by taking the game very seriously, you realize how silly it is.
Right.
And, you know, I'm trying to think of a With Lyrics I would have done that really, you know, okay, there's a Bubble Man lyric that is exclusive to the CD.
Right.
And it points out, you know, a pretty old joke in the gaming community, but it tries to make satire of the fact that Bubble Man is a pretty useless boss.
Yeah.
And on top of having a useless weapon, he's really pretty easy. But the thing is, when I watch my friends play current gen games, I realize that there are still stupid conventions in any video game.
Oh, definitely.
You're still running around. You know, we thought, oh, it's so stupid that you pull a turkey leg out of the wall in Castlevania. Well, you know what? We still find shields on the ground. We still find discarded med packs and food that somehow give us life. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, we can absorb like 20 bullets, hide behind a wall for 10 seconds, and we're all good to go again. Yeah,
exactly. There will always be dumb shit in video games because it's just part of the conventions of video games, and that's part of what I love about them. And as long as there's stuff to make fun of, I feel like it's my job to make fun of it. So why not expand my ability by getting into the games that, you know, are being played right now. So that's kind of the overarching idea behind me getting more into current-gen gaming.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. Like I said, I very much look forward to seeing more, you know, some takes on more recent things that as you get into them and stuff. But as far as like, producing your songs, like, what's your process? I mean, if you were just summarize the process from conceptualizing, you know, what kind of take you're going to go into a song to actually producing a video for it?
Well, you know, I've been doing it long enough that I can give you a rough idea, but I will disclaim it by saying it is certainly case by case. The 2-2 Blues was a ridiculously fast, literally all in one evening of event, which you can sort of tell because of the way it's edited. It's very simple. It's not flashy, but more often, I'll write, well, even before I write the draft of a lyric, I'll just start getting a song in my head. It'll start kind of infecting my brain. I'll start whistling it or humming it or whatever.
Yeah.
And that it'll stay there. And it can stay there for a couple weeks, a couple months. And suddenly I'll link it with an idea. Something will click. You know, it's not anything I can control, but it happens regularly enough. Yeah, it happens regularly enough that I can expect that it'll continue happening. But once that happens, I'll write a lyric, and the lyric usually sits for a while. I'll write a first draft. I mean, for instance, I've been sitting on a Kirby lyric since November. I'll look at it from time to time, and it's just not ready. Why do I have this as my process? Couldn't tell you. Wouldn't be my choice if I could choose my process, but it's like, it's almost like sometimes lyrics need to incubate. I don't know why, but it's like they need to stay up on the shelf. They need to somehow ripen. Even though they're not changing, I'm just changing and being able to be more objective. Then I'll pick the lyric back up and I'll make some adjustments. And at that point, it's time to figure out the accompaniment, which is usually a sequence that I do on my keyboard.
Mm.
And then I, you know, it's been pretty much the same process since I've started. I hook up my keyboard to my MacBook. I record it in GarageBand. I get under my covers, literally my comforter, and take my laptop under there, and I just sing the song into the MacBook mic, edit that together. Once I have the, you know, then I have the song. After that, I will do principal photography, or if there's no photography, I will, you know, basically little by little, I'll get all my little Photoshop stills together. I'm sort of storyboarding it in my mind. And, you know, once the video editing process is done, sometimes I need to go back and add some more sound effects. Or, for instance, with Final Fantasy VI with Beerix, it wasn't funny enough when I did the original rough cut. And you'll notice in Final Fantasy with Beerix, there's a lot of strange call and answer type stuff. I'm going to euphemize myself as if we're in church, but after you hear in my other pants there's a wallet, you also hear me kind of whispering in the other side of your speakers, "That's a wallet, mother effa." And that wasn't originally in there, but I just was like, something needs to spice this up. It's not funny enough. So you'll go back and you'll do what you have to do, and you know, I'll export it, I'll send it to a couple of friends. Sometimes I'll send it to Screwtack, be like, "What do you guys think?" And at that point, you know, it just gets uploaded. But, you know, the process from first writing the draft of the lyric to dropping a video on YouTube can take so long. Though most of it is filled with that time when you're just kind of letting it wait to happen. I mean, I'm sitting on a Castlevania 2 draft. I'm sitting on, that Zelda ending song and, many little ideas that I at any given time have running around. I'm working on a Yoshi's Island athletic theme.
Oh, nice.
You know, there's always things that are bouncing around just waiting to happen. But a good example of this is that the second with lyrics lyric I ever wrote was the Mega Man 2 title theme. But that didn't actually drop till December of 08, even though I wrote it in July of 08. That's just a good example of, like, things just need to bake in my brain. Why am I like that? Couldn't tell you. But that's kind of how I work in general.
Cool. Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there's others that are like that. I think that, especially when it comes to something like that, something where you're specifically creating something, and especially if it's anything that involves, in my opinion, if it's anything that involves words, especially with lyrics in particular, because you want things, oftentimes you want things to rhyme, you want things to kind of flow a certain way. It does help to, like, sit and have things rest a while. As you put it, there it's incubating, but what's actually going on is, like, you're kind of spacing yourself away from it so you can come back to it later with a more, like, objective take
Absolutely.
On it, like your palate's cleaned out.
Yeah, I look at it as, this is nerd alert, you know, but pointillistic painting, like the island, you know, Impressionism was a style of painting where, as you probably know, I don't know if all the listeners know, but where it wasn't so much that the painting looked exactly like what it was, but every brush stroke was like a pixel. So when you back up, they all blend together and you see the bigger picture. Well, think about what it must have been like for the artist. When you're up close and your nose is to that canvas, you don't see the whole painting. You see a couple of pixels. And in the same way, once you've written the draft, you're only able to really look at the details. You can't see the bigger picture.
Exactly.
It's almost as if that time is a time during which, if it's a painting in this, you know, analogy, that paint is drying and you're able to slowly back away and look at the whole painting rather than those little details. That's kind of how I think of it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. That definitely makes sense. That's kind of a cool way to look at it. I know, I mean, with my work, the editorial-based work I do, I actually kind of try to do the opposite, but that's because I'm not, when I write my reviews, I'm not creating art. I'm commenting on art. I'm critiquing it. And so for me, it actually makes more sense to do that in the opposite way, to I guess, going with your painting metaphor, to look at the painting and try to express what I'm seeing before I step too close, because then that could happen. I might start seeing a lot of the details that ultimately, like, don't really matter because I'm not looking at the whole painting at that point. I'm just looking at the little pixels, as you put it.
Right.
And so with my reviews, this isn't how I used to write them, but the process that I've come to is I'll play a game, and I'm just kind of the type of person where I'm such an analytical personality type, and this is actually why I enjoyed critiquing your album, because whether I intend to or not, I'm constantly analyzing any media or art I take in some
sure.
degree. And so I'll play through a game. When I feel I'm done with it, whether I've completed it or if I've just played enough where I feel like I've experienced all I'm going to get out of it, then I'll sit and I'll write my review. And almost all of my reviews over the past year, I will write within an hour. And when I'm done writing them, I try to not go back and edit them until they're already live, which that probably sounds backwards because I'm supposed to be an editor. Like, obviously, I try to make sure I catch grammatical and spelling things, but I try not to actually read what I wrote, because I feel like if I do, I'm going to start thinking, oh, well, maybe I'm being too harsh here, maybe I'm being too generous here, but I feel like it makes more sense to just write how I felt, you know, after experiencing what I've experienced, and because I'm just doing that, that's more my genuine feelings of what I got out of that experience.
Right.
With that
piece it's a matter of preserving the spirit in which the original was intended, while still making sure that the format is more correct or without flaws.
Yeah. So okay. I mean, so I guess for anyone listening out there who follows my reviews, there's a little there's a little look into how I go about my process. But actually, another question I have here is, how do you handle when people criticize your work? Like when people are like, well, you're ruining these games by adding lyrics to them because they were never designed to. And one person left a comment on my review comparing what you're doing to going to a museum and scribbling all over all the Mona Lisa and like doing stuff like that and like drawing mustaches on the statues or whatever. How do you take that?
Well, the thing is, first off, I'm going to tell you, I read the same comment, and the thing is, if somebody would say to me that the art form of transforming another art form is unnecessary or is destructive, I would say, yes, it is both of those things, but people fucking love it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, there is always someone in any classroom who needs to be the one making, doing a presentation in the front of the classroom. And there's always some asshole who needs to be making a snide comment about it. And the thing is, in the classroom setting, the asshole making the snide comment gets in trouble. But in life, that person is the clown. You know what
yeah.
I mean? That
yeah.
person is, in my opinion, whether the art is necessary, that person is a necessary cog in the entire machine. We need people that are producing the original stuff, and we need people that are making fun of it, period. And sometimes I am the one who produces the original stuff, as in my musicals and certain, original pieces that I do on YouTube and so forth, but both are necessary. If someone... in the case of this particular commenter, this is someone who writes video game music, who thinks that it is, that it denigrates the original. And I would tell that person, I just had a conversation this last week with Christopher Tin. Christopher Tin wrote the smash hit Baba Yetu, which is the title theme to Civilization IV, very
yeah.
like Lion King sounding choral piece. And he was actually pretty excited when I contacted him on Twitter and told him I was going to be doing it with lyrics of his song. At some point, if a song's not that great, there's plenty of games that I might want to make fun of, but there's not a song that I really want to latch onto.
Right.
So, in my opinion, it's a compliment. If someone, the commenter is someone I don't know, and I don't want to pass judgment on someone I don't know, but in general, I would think that if anyone were worried about their art being tainted by somebody else coming in and adding a derivative thing onto it, I think that would probably be a matter of their own security with their own art. And
yeah.
that's just my opinion about it.
No, and I honestly, I agree with that. I mean, as someone who critiques other people's work, like, I'm very much of the opinion that if you don't want your work critiqued or altered or made fun of or anything, then don't put it out to the masses. I mean,
right. That's
kind of my opinion on it. So I probably very much agree with your thoughts on that kind of comment. Which actually reminds me of something else. A couple people, not just like on Go Nintendo or wherever, but a couple people I know have been talking about how they think it's unjust that you're profiting from music that other people have composed. And your response on your YouTube channel was, well, that's what Weird Al used to do, and in some cases still does. Like, so. Could you maybe like explain like how that works? I guess I'm just curious as
sure,
to like the technicality
sure.
of it.
Well, let me go into the legal part, but then also the philosophical. Legally, okay. In a document so old that it's actually the Constitution actually specifically makes parody okay, and you know it, because it's a matter of freedom of speech. When you take a piece of art, and then you make a joke out of that using that same piece of art or using a structural implement like the music, you are creating something new. And the thing is, the framers realized that satire is a necessary part of the culture in the same way that the, you know, snide commenter in the back of the classroom, while he might get in trouble in a classroom setting, on a broader scale, that voice is a necessary voice in society.
I guess thinking about it from a more political standpoint, like, I can't imagine what our political world would be like if we didn't have the Conan O'Briens of the world. Like, you know,
Conan O'Brien, John Stewart.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, it's fine. Keep going.
So basically, the thing is, video games are different, but at some point, if I threw the lyrics and making a point that hasn't been made, and I'm not actually using the original recording, then it is a new piece of art. Derivative or not, it is a new thing unto itself, and it is recognized as parody. And because of that, there's actually no legal requirement for anyone doing a parody to ask permission. The reason for that is most people being parodied would refuse, especially politicians. Or you know, if you were required to ask George Bush to do a satire of him or a parody of him, it would be unlikely that he would or Barack Obama. Let's be fair. Anyone in power, if you had to ask their permission to do a parody, in most cases they would say no. But that's why parody is protected, because it's necessary. Well, okay. So what I do is a couple notches away from from protesting tyranny in the government or something like that.
Yeah.
But the concept is still the same, which is why people like Weird Al have been able to do what they do. Now, people like to cite the case of Weird Al and Coolio. Now, the thing is, Weird Al did not ask Coolio's permission to use the Gangster's Paradise song as Amish Paradise. He got in trouble with Coolio, but he was not sued. He just pissed Coolio off.
Yeah.
And Coolio didn't actually have a case. He was just upset and made that public. The big joke of all that is that Coolio used Stevie Wonder's song. What's that song called? Let's see. Hold on. I'm Googling because I want to make a point.
That's fine.
Pastime Paradise. Stevie Wonder had a song most people don't know anymore called Pastime Paradise. The best friend the most alive living in the pastime paradise. Like, they basically lifted that directly. I'm sure Coolio asked permission for that, but the thing is, it's not like he wrote something that wasn't derivative himself.
Yeah.
So it's hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that said, on a more philosophical level, first off, I just was covering that legally, I am protected. But let's pretend there might be an ethical problem with me doing this. The thing is, I explained this in my video, and I'm going to explain it again. Nintendo is a wise company. They've done very well. They are responsible for the revitalization of the home arcade, and if not for them, there would be no Sega, there would be no PlayStation, etc. Well, the thing is, they know about branding. They know about marketing, and I am not the first performer or group or artist to take video game music and regurgitate it in my own way. The mini bosses, the Neskimos are some of the earliest names I remember hearing. I'm sure there's some others, but the reason Nintendo doesn't outright sue these bands that make money with their recordings and performances of the songs is Nintendo is wise enough to know that these bands are just promoting the brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, this is what happens when somebody hears a song from their childhood, especially now with stuff like the Wii Virtual Console. If somebody goes and hears a really catchy little lyric about Mega Man 3, they're likely, or at least more likely than 5 minutes before, to go and buy that on the Virtual Console. Now, if I wrote songs like, you know, using Nintendo music about how Nintendo is an awful company, or how Nintendo, something truly denigrating, well, that might get me in more trouble.
Right, but you don't do that.
I don't. And the thing is, ultimately, I'm promoting their brand, not in a way that, like, you know, makes me a shill for their brand, just that they know that what I'm doing is basically free advertising for them. So they would be remiss to sue me or the Megas or Daniel Tidwell or any of these groups that, and there's probably, you know, even just in America, probably 30 to 50 groups that,
yeah,
you know, make a significant portion of their income doing this.
Yeah.
And they don't get sued because Nintendo's smart enough to know, A, that would be bad PR, and B, these groups are all making Nintendo money in the end.
Yeah, in some faster than other, yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with you. I was actually glad that you pointed that out in that FAQ because, like, to me, I guess in a way that's always been, like, common sense to me when I started getting into stuff like this. It actually wasn't until later that I was like, wait a minute, how are these people, like, making a profit off of this? Isn't there something wrong with that? But, you know, eventually I thought about it some more. I was like, oh, well, duh. People like these are just promoting these brands in pop culture, like in their own ways. I mean, it's why Family Guy gets away with so many of the things that Family Guy does, because even, I mean, obviously Family Guy's a little different because there are definitely times when that show deliberately is supposed to be mocking and ridiculing something. But on the other hand, there's so many cases where they're just parodying or spoofing some brand or some show or some, you know, some type of media in their show, and in doing so, they're promoting that in a way, in their own kind of bizarre, you know, offbeat way, but they're doing that same type of thing.
Sure.
And like you said, we need, like, in our kind of society, we need some people that are doing that and preventing ourselves from taking ourselves too seriously. And
exactly.
Yeah, so that's definitely some interesting stuff to think about. But we're nearing about an hour here, if not a little bit beyond, depending on how I might edit things out. But so is there any kind of thoughts you'd like to leave people with? Any kind of specific teases of any upcoming work?
Okay, so I plan to do soon a shot for shot redux of the original DuckTales video about adding new lyrics that are actually, you know, on the CD cut of it.
Yeah.
And as, you know, redux is a word that I guess is originally French or something, and it's spelled R-E-D-U-X, but in this case it will be R-E-D-U-C-K-S. And that idea goes to, a guy that I met in New Jersey who, I feel awful, his name escapes me, but he had that idea, and I gotta go back and figure out his name, because I'm totally crediting him with the idea of calling it Redux. But also, the Civilization IV opener, which is Baba Yetu, I plan to do a lyric to that, which would be my first PC game. And, you know, by the way, I am actually, there's a period of my life where I was very into PC games. Most of them did not have amazing scores with catchy tunes.
Yeah.
But Thief, Half-Life, Deus Ex, Civilization, a couple others, Fear, are games that, you know, like could one day see the light of day with lyrics, but this will be the first PC game. I already said that thing about the Zelda. I do have, you know, people that have been following me closely will have heard about this once or twice before, but I am starting the process on a new animated video with Parker Simon. He, for those of you that don't know, is the animator from Dr. Mario.
Oh, that was a great one.
Very, very talented animator. I feel like that video without him would, well, I mean, it's coming up on a million viewer, and I feel like it wouldn't even be near that if not for his prowess.
That animation definitely, like, took that particular video, like, up to, like, a different kind of level of quality in terms, like, just the fact that it was animated in and of itself was really evocative of your work anyway, so that, I'm excited to see some more stuff from that guy with your work.
Right, and we're doing, we're kind of taking a different, you know, I was afraid that if we did a second thing that it would be kind of considered a sequel, because his visual style is pretty specific. I didn't want anyone to go, I like Dr. Mario better. The way to do that is to, instead of making a second Apple after the first Apple, is just coming out with an orange. So nobody can really compare. So what we're doing is, the Kermit the Frog song, it's not easy being green. I always thought, I bet Luigi would sing the same thing.
that sounds awesome.
In the shadow of his brother. So I've made a lyric that's slightly altered from the original Kermit the Frog version. It's not easy wearing green. And it involves Luigi and Mario having a birthday on the same day. And anyway, the thing is, it will probably take the better part of a year just based on how long it takes to animate and the fact that Parker's got a real job on top of that.
Yeah.
But just some really exciting opportunities with animation. Those are the teasers that I can give that I can definitely say within the year will become reality. But
cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I guess just as a sending off, is there anything you have to say to, like, the fans that have been following you, people that have pre-ordered or pre-ordered your CD, or a message to people who haven't yet, and how you might convince them?
Well, I mean, I will say that for the first time in the history of Brenel Floss, I have a unit. I have a unit that is something that, you know, a lot of websites, including Wikipedia and many blogs, ask you to donate. And that has been kind of my MO since I started. You know, sort of like part of the incentive for me to do it was that people would throw me a few bucks here and there, and it would help pay the rent sometimes. Well, now I have a unit, and it's not only a unit that helps me out, it's a unit that I completely stand by and feel like, you know, I just feel like on the whole, anyone that halfway likes what I do on the internet will not be disappointed by this. So, I mean, you know, I'd say read Eddie's review, and there are definitely a lot of previews floating around the internet that sort of show the increased quality of the recordings.
Yeah.
But it's a CD with something for everyone, and you know, makes a great gift. I don't know. that's pretty much my pitch.
Okay. And what do you have to say to the people who have already pre-ordered it?
Oh man, you guys are awesome. You guys are my base. You're my core. You guys are the people that, in many cases, you know, made it possible for me to get to where I am now. And so, you know, you guys are the fact that you wanted it first, that you wanted to sign, and that, let's be honest, frankly, you're willing to pay a little bit more for it, than say, you know, like, some band goes straight to iTunes for $10. You guys are paying a little bit more, because you're getting something that is collectible. You're getting something that really is personal, and that really, I mean, you know, it's easy for artists to take for granted that they have fans or whatever, but this is not one of those times for me. I'm very, very excited and kind of, in a way, reassured that the fans out there really are out there by the response I've gotten so far, so I do appreciate that.
Awesome. One last question that my wife wanted me to ask you.
Oh, hey, wifey.
she just wants you to know that she is kidding, but she just wanted to see how you'd react to this question. But having listened to your music, she wanted to know, like, compared to how you act in your songs, like, how much of a douchebag are you in real life?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. Brenel Floss is, now, I, you know, this is the last one quick question. I'll do my best to keep it quick, but as you've found out over the last hour, I can certainly ramble. You know, Brenel Floss is, at his most douchey, he is the far end of a spectrum. And we have in us, everyone, a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
And at his worst, Brennelfloss is my Mr. Hyde. You know, everyone has someone they turn into when they're drunk, when they're surly, when they're angry, when they're whatever it is. They have the dark side of the moon. And in a way, Brennelfloss is kind of my dark side of the moon. But, you know, it's an exaggerated version of some of the sides of myself, but hopefully cast in a comic light. So day to day, I'm not that much of a douchebag because you can't be. You really just can't be that much of a dick or people will start to notice. I tend to be, you know, pretty nice, pretty happy-go-lucky. I'll knock heads if I need to, but, you know.
Yeah.
In general, you know, if you listen to the Tetris song, the most true part of that song is when I say, just kidding about the
bitch. Just kidding about the bitch part. I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I just, you know, my wife just wanted me to squeeze in there, see how you'd react. But no, that's great. I mean, I think anyone who listens to this is going to be able to have a good idea of what kind of a guy you are. And just anyone who maybe downplays the thought that goes into your work, I think ought to give this a listen, because that definitely... I mean, I definitely think that a lot of the ideas that you put into this are a lot deeper than what people would expect, given the nature of the work. And so,
sure.
I mean, as one of your fans, I'm just really, you know, happy that I got to discuss these sorts of things with you and find out, you know, just how, not that you just enjoy your work or that you have fun with it, but like you really do seem to think about it and consider a lot of things on a more deep level than people might expect, and that's pretty awesome.
Well, thanks.
But yeah, so this has been pretty great. I'm honored that I got to sit and talk with you here. I'm hoping that a number of your fans will love to hear you more. You know, to hear more about your discussion, about your work, and about your past and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I guess that'll wrap things up here this episode. So, thanks a lot for listening to the Same Skycast, guys. And if you're interested, one of the main elements I'm promoting with this podcast is that, of course, I want to incorporate as many opinions as I can. So do feel free to send an email to my email address if you'd be interested in participating in a future episode. For the month of April, I'm trying to get a massive Pokemon-themed episode. So if you have any thoughts about the Pokemon franchise, definitely shoot me an email, give me a recording, a written email, anything, and we'll get those going together. But until next time, this is Eddie Fettig. Thanks for listening. Later days, guys.